It was 2 days before the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The religious leaders who collaborated with the Roman occupation were conspiring against Jesus. They had gathered in the place of the palace of Caiaphas, the high priest. This man had received the high priesthood at the hands of Valerius Gratus, the former Roman governor, and now retained the office under Pontius Pilate. They all were planning to arrest and destroy Jesus quietly so as to avoid a popular revolt among the Jews. At this time, Jesus was lodging at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper. While he was there, a woman approached and anointed him with an alabaster jar of pure nard. When his disciples saw the act, they were outraged.
"Why this haste?
Such costly ointment may have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor."
"Why do you bother the woman? The poor are always with you. Indeed, I tell you that wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will be told in her memory."
Then one of the 12, named Judas, son of Simon the Iscariot, went to the priests and asked,
"What will you give me if I deliver Jesus to you?"
When they heard the offer, they were glad and promised Judas 30 pieces of silver. From that hour, he sought an opportunity to betray Jesus. At the beginning of the feast, when the Passover lamb was sacrificed, the disciples of Jesus approached him and asked,
"Where do you wish to prepare the Paschal meal?"
"Go into the city, and you will see there a man carrying a water jar. He will show you a suitable place."
The two did as Jesus commanded. They entered the city, where they found the man with the water jar, who brought them to a large upper room. When evening had come, Jesus arrived with the 12. While they were eating, he said,
"I tell you truly that one of you is going to betray me."
The disciples were stunned with grief.
"Surely not I."
"Nor I."
"Nor I."
"The betrayer is one of you dipping his hand in the dish with me. The Son of Man is fulfilling the scripture, but woe to that one through whom the Son of Man is betrayed."
Then Judas slipped out into the night. As they were eating, Jesus took bread. After reciting the blessing, he broke it and gave it to his disciples.
"Take, eat, this is my body."
Then taking the cup with the traditional blessing, he gave it to his disciples.
"This is my blood of the new covenant, which is being shed for many. I tell you in truth that I shall not drink again from the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it fresh in the kingdom of God."
Then, having sung a hymn, they left the city for the Mount of Olives. As they walked, Jesus said to his disciples,
"You will all desert me this very night. So it is written in the prophet Zechariah, 'Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered.'"
"Though all desert, I will remain by you."
"I tell you truly that in this very night, before the cock crows twice, you shall deny me 3 times.
"Even though I must die with you, I will never deny you."
And so declared all the disciples. Jesus halted at an olive grove called Gethsemane. Then, going apart with Peter, James, and John, he left them on watch and continued a little further alone. There he fell on his face in anguished prayer. Soon he returned to the 3 on watch and found them sleeping.
"Could you not watch with me for just 1 hour? Watch and pray that you are not put to the test, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak."
Again, Jesus went apart in troubled prayer. And again, He returned to find the disciples sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. A third time, Jesus withdrew to pray, and a third time, he found the disciples sleeping.
Sleep on and finish your rest. Now is the time for the Son of Man to be delivered into the hands of sinners. Here comes my betrayer.
Jesus had not finished speaking before Judas, one of his own disciples, arrived with a group of Roman soldiers and other armed men from the temple. Now the betrayer had arranged with the authorities for a sign and had said,
"The man whom I kiss is the one you want."
In accord with this arrangement, Judas went directly to Jesus.
"Greetings, Master."
Then he gave him the kiss.
"Judas, would you betray the Son of Man with a kiss?"
Immediately the soldiers laid hands on Jesus and held him fast. Then one of the disciples with Jesus drew his sword and cut off an ear from the slave of the high priest.
"Sheathe your sword. All who take up the sword will perish by the sword. Do you not know that I can call upon God, who will respond at once with more than 12 legions of angels?"
Then turning to the mob, Jesus continued,
"Have you come for me as against a rebel bandit with swords and clubs? Why did you not seize me in the temple where I sat teaching by day? Were you afraid of the Jewish people that you must come for me by stealth? Nevertheless, your actions are fulfilling the words of the prophets."
Then all the disciples forsook him. Those who had seized Jesus brought him to Caiaphas, whom the Romans had made high priest. Peter followed at a distance as far as the courtyard. There he sat with the attendants and warmed himself by the fire. The high priest had gathered his whole council, and they began to arrange the case against Jesus, which they would present to Pontius Pilate, the governor. The charge was that Jesus claimed to be king of the Jews. And they brought in many false witnesses, but to no avail. Finally, two came forward.
"We heard this man say, 'I will tear down this temple made with hands and within 3 days build another not made with hands.'"
The testimony was evidence that Jesus claimed an authority over temple affairs, which traditionally belonged only to the rulers of Israel. And in those days, Israel was ruled from Rome. Yet even these witnesses were unable to agree on their testimony. Finally, Caiaphas stood up and examined Jesus directly.
"Have you no answer to these charges?"
Jesus remained silent and answered nothing. Then the high priest put the question of kingship in terms of the royal titles, anointed and Son of God.
"Are you the anointed one, the Son of the Blessed?"
"I am. And you shall see the Son of Man seated on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven."
"What need have we of witnesses? He has condemned himself."
They all concurred that Jesus was indeed worthy of death. Then those holding Jesus began to spit on him. They covered his face and were striking him as they taunted him.
"O anointed one, prophesy who it is who is striking you."
Now Peter was warming himself in the courtyard when a small slave girl entered. She confronted Peter and said,
"You also were with this Jesus of Nazarene."
"I do not know what you are talking about."
Peter went outside into the gateway. Meanwhile, the cock crowed. The slave girl followed him out and said to the bystanders,
"This man is one of them."
Again, Peter denied knowing Jesus. After a little while, the bystanders said directly to Peter,
"Surely you are one of them, for you speak with a Galilean accent."
Then Peter began to swear with an oath.
I do not know this person of whom you are speaking.
But the cock interrupted him as it crowed for the second time. Immediately, Peter remembered how Jesus had said to him, "Before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." He went out and wept bitterly. When morning arrived, all of the chief priests, along with the other Roman collaborators, bound Jesus and delivered him over to Pontius Pilate, the imperial Roman governor. When Judas saw what was happening, he knew that Jesus was doomed and repented. He returned the 30 pieces of silver to the priests.
I have sinned in betraying innocent blood.
What is that to us? That is your affair.
Judas threw down the 30 pieces of silver in the temple. Then he went out and hanged himself. Picking up the silver pieces, the priest said,
"It is unlawful to put this silver into the treasury, for it is blood money."
Whereupon they used the money to buy the potter's field for the burial of strangers. Therefore, that field is known to this day as the field of blood. Jesus stood before the Roman governor as the accusers made their charge.
"We found this man perverting our nation. He was forbidding us to pay taxes to the emperor and proclaiming himself anointed king."
"Are you the king of the Jews?"
"You say so."
The priests were accusing him of many things.
"Have you no answer to give? Look at how many accusations they are making."
Jesus astonished Pilate by remaining silent. At the festival, the governor used to release a prisoner, and some were urging Pilate to do so at this time. Now there was a notable rebel in prison with those who had committed murder during the insurrection. His name was Jesus Barabbas. Therefore, the priests arranged a demonstration to demand Barabbas.
"Whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus, the appointed one?"
"Barabbas."
"What shall I do then with Jesus, the anointed one?"
"Crucify."
"Are you certain of his guilt?"
The crowd took up the chant.
"Crucify.
"Shall I crucify your king?"
Then Pilate agreed to release Jesus Barabbas, but Jesus, the anointed king, he handed over to his soldiers for scourging and crucifixion. The soldiers led Jesus away within the governor's palace. There they assembled the whole battalion. They clothed Jesus in royal purple. They set a crown of thorns upon his head and shoved a reed between his fingers for a scepter. They began to mock him by kneeling before him.
"King of the Jews."
They also spat upon him and smote him on the head with a stick. Then, after mocking him, they took away the purple, returned his own clothes, and brought him out to crucify him. On the road, they met an African of Cyrene named Simon, coming in from the countryside. Him they compelled to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to a place called Golgotha, which means skull. There they crucified him. It was 9 in the morning. They offered him wine mingled with myrrh, but he refused it. His garments they divided among themselves, casting lots for them. Over his head they inscribed the charge against him, "The King of the Jews." Also, there were two insurrectionists crucified with him, one to his right hand and one to his left. Those who passed by were shaking their heads in derision.
"So you would destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days.
Save yourself.
Come down from the cross.
Likewise, the priestly collaborators mocked him.
He saved others, yet himself he cannot save. Let the Anointed One, the King of Israel, come down from the cross that we may see and believe.
Even the two crucified with him reviled him. Now from midday there was darkness over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. At that hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice,
"Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me?"
"Look, he is calling for Elijah."
One of them put a sponge full of vinegar on a stick and laid it to his lips.
"Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down."
Then Jesus, having uttered a loud cry, breathed his last breath. Suddenly, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from the top to the bottom. The earth shook and the rocks were split. Even the tombs of the dead were open. Now, when the centurion on watch and the others who were with him saw all that was taking place, they were filled with awe.
"Truly, this was the Son of God."
Very significant part in the dramatic rendering of the Passion of Our Christ that you just heard is played by the timpani, the kettle drums, throughout the narrative. The alternating rhythms of that deep roll throughout are not only heard with the ears, but at least for me, and I imagine for you too, felt deep down, a kind of rolling undercurrent of sorrow and sadness, seriousness and sin, as if to me a sound emanating from the center of reality. St. Paul says in the 8th chapter of his letter to the Romans that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains, and not only creation, but we ourselves. And I think that gets at it for me, as I have shared in other contexts. I think that at the heart of life, there is a deep down groan. The deep rumble of timpani dramatizes this for all of us. I don't mean to say that we're all walking around groaning all the time. That's certainly not the case. Some do, and some of them for very good reason. No, in fact, for the vast majority of us, certainly most of us here, life is working. Almost. We are grateful for our blessings, but that does not drown out that low rumble deep down. I listened to a presentation of an addictions counselor about a month ago, and he told that this is what he has learned. It is hard to get enough of something that almost works. It is hard to get enough of something that almost works. And I thought of us. I thought of me. Because, man, this is a place, if you look around, where life works. Almost. So we try harder, and we try harder, and we try harder in spite of or because of the sneaking suspicion that success, however good, will not actually bring us joy. Because of the desperate fear of trying to get through one day without a drink, the internet images burned on our brains, the empty space at the kitchen table, the lump discovered on the breast, the lingering shame of a particular moral failure, the impossible to ever really please parent, the ongoing inattention to God that makes us feel guilty. This is such a friendly place. This is such a friendly city on the whole. When I go out, past people on the street, in the grocery store, at restaurants, I usually have a habit of looking at people, looking in their faces, and they seem to have a habit of doing the same. They look back and people say hello in this town. Except in the halls of our hospitals, that's a different environment, of course. Faces are bent downward. Foreheads are furrowed. People talk in more clipped sentences. Grave. There are few smiles, of course. The poet Jane Kenyon speaks of human experience in the image of that day we imagine is coming for us when the young nurse walks in our hospital room with the big needle. Spiritually and metaphorically speaking, we are in the hospital today. This week, Holy Week, when we Christians confess that to say life almost works is to say that it doesn't work, and to admit that we need treatment, medicine, a cure. And so the rolling timpani takes us back and down and deep to where our ancestors in the faith lived and learned in Scripture and were reborn as a people discovering what it is to hope. You see, the breakthrough for Israel, the real spiritual breakthrough for the people of God, happened at their lowest point in exile in Babylon. When Israel realized, despite their efforts to make life work on their own, clearly it was not working, and in fact, they were helpless without a direct divine intervention. That was the only thing they could hope for. The real breakthrough is there in those big, intimidating books of the Old Testament like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, that if ever life was truly going to work and go on for all the world, not just for them, God would have to do it. Make matters right once for all. And they were told that they could hope in that. God gave them the promise that they were right to hope in that very thing. Isaiah speaks to that part of our lives that isn't working in many various images, but he says these words: I know how to sustain the weary with a word. And he points to the image of the morning. The morning is coming. When is that morning coming? Well, of course, it's coming next Sunday. Yes, but not yet. It is too soon. We would do well to let the timpani roll on for some more days, to let this complicated, chaotic, and brutal thing we just heard again linger in us a bit longer, contemplating why and how it matters. And the church provides you that space with these beautiful, powerful Holy Week liturgies. At the heart of every serious religion is this issue, the issue of separation from the gods, and something must be done to repair the rift. The marvel of Christianity is the lengths to which God will go to do so, because nothing could be farther from God than the curse of the crucifixion. And so there we see that there is no distance that is too great where we are finally, once for all, ever outside of God's redemptive reach. His arms of love stretched out on the hardwood of the cross. Almost all religions deal with sacrifices that people have to make to serve their gods. Our ancestors in faith had it revealed to them that it doesn't work that way. It never will. The cross of Jesus is the sacrifice God makes to serve us. And we need to have it revealed to us again and again and again. So once more this week, we understand that the needle intended for us is actually the spear that pierces God's heart of love instead. Only our God has wounds, a reality that sounds forth again from the center of reality, like timpani on our ears, like kettle drums in our souls.